From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And fears of a trade war are rattling Wall Street today. The Dow dropped more than 500 points on news that President Trump is targeting Chinese goods coming into the U.S. with about $60 billion in new tariffs. He spoke at the White House today.
Just use the word reciprocal. If they charge us, we charge them the same thing. That's the way it's got to be. That's not the way it is. For many, many years, for many decades, it has not been that way.
The president says he's responding to China's theft of U.S. commercial secrets and its demand that U.S. companies hand over intellectual property in exchange for access to the Chinese market. NPR's Anthony Kuhn joins us from Beijing. And Anthony, China watchers say that China was already responding before this, trying to get across a message that they're reforming. Is there a sense they were? What's the reaction there?
Basically, Robin, they've been saying for a while, China's not looking to pick a fight with the U.S. over trade, but if someone picks a fight with us, we're not going to take it sitting down. They have many ways to retaliate. They're also saying, look, this violates global trade rules. When you have a trade dispute, you take it for arbitration before the World Trade Organization. You don't slap tariffs unilaterally. So I think they've had plenty of time to prepare, and we should see pretty soon what they're going to do in response.
Well, as you know, industry groups in the U.S. have already sent a letter to President Trump warning that the Chinese will then punish the U.S. So what are some of the U.S. industries that might get hurt?
Right. Well, the big ticket items are things like airplanes. China buys a lot from Boeing. They may now go to Airbus instead. Agricultural products are very important, things like soybeans and sorghum and wheat. And it just so happens that a lot of those products come from big agricultural states which have voted Republican. And so that gives China a way to retaliate in a very targeted way where they can hit China trade hawks in their own constituencies if they want to.
Look, there haven't been that many tariffs recently because we have trade deals and we have the WTO, which you mentioned. But in China, are they seeing this as a new trade war?
No, I think they've seen this coming for a long time. They sent a high-level trade envoy to Washington, and he was basically rebuffed. And then we also had the steel and aluminum tariffs, which China has yet to respond to. Again, there, they said they were reforming. They've been cutting their production capacity of those.
Well, this also comes as China, South Korea are, you know, a part of the possible upcoming talks with North Korea. How does this affect that?
It could affect cooperation, but I don't think it's going to be that bad because, first of all, China is really interested in a solution in the North Korean nuclear issue. And second of all, they're sort of out of the hot seat right now because the U.S. has agreed to talk to North Korea. I think the bigger thing to watch out here for is Taiwan. China is extremely angry that President Trump just signed the Taiwan Travel Act and that a high-ranking State Department official went straight to Taipei right after that. So I think if there's anything that scuppers cooperation, Taiwan's going to be it.
So, Anthony Kuhn, with your very educated guess, what do you think is going to happen here? You know, the Trump administration, you know, really throwing down this big gauntlet, hoping to change Chinese practices, you know, a little bit of bluster maybe. But is there a sense that China may change its practices, or is this going to hurt President Xi, who's been moving to consolidate his own power, president for life, if it in fact hurts the Chinese economy? I mean, where do you see it going?
I think the Chinese are not so exercised about this because they feel the threat to them is not so great. Look, the 2008 financial crisis was a much bigger hit to external demand, and they got through it. Sure, they lost jobs, but, you know, this is the direction they want to go in. They want to get out of these, like, low-margin manufacturing things and up into high-tech, high-profit. And this is going to just push them in the direction they want to go anyway. Part of this is something really important. That is that half of China's exports are made in China by foreign companies anyway. So let's take an example. Let's say, like, a hiking boot or a Nike sneaker or something. Although it's assembled in China, China really just gets paid for the labor. It's an American company, and at the end of the day, the thing says made in China. The other way to look at that is that 30 or 40 years ago, that thing might have been made in China by an American firm, and it would have been too expensive for most Chinese consumers to buy. Now, China has a middle class that's bigger than the entire population of the U.S. So even if foreigners are not buying their exports, there's a huge domestic market.
And what is your sense? I mean, is your sense that China is still dispatching hackers to steal commercial secrets and, you know, taking trade secrets from the U.S.?
The main issue here is intellectual property protection. And yes, if you go out on the street in China, you will immediately see things like knockoff Gucci bags and pirated Hollywood movies on DVDs. But this has happened in a lot of other countries, too. When those countries are poor, people don't care if they're real. Once they start getting money, they want the real thing, and quality becomes the overriding issue. Chinese companies have their own intellectual property, and they are the ones now demanding protection from the Chinese government. So the dynamic has really changed, and that's why I think China is not quite so worried about it.
NPR's Anthony Kuhn in Beijing. Anthony, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Well, from talk of a trade war between the U.S. and China to the ongoing war of words between the U.K. and Russia over the poisoning of a former Russian spy and his daughter in England, British Prime Minister Theresa May is in Brussels today asking the European Union to condemn the nerve agent attack, which the U.K. blames on Moscow.
Russia staged a brazen and reckless attack against the United Kingdom when it attempted the murder of two people on the streets of Salisbury.
Russia has denied any involvement in the poisoning. Joining us now from London is BBC political correspondent Rob Watson. And Rob, what does Theresa May want the EU to do about this nerve agent attack in Britain?
I mean, that's not massively clear. I think that Britain has been rather careful not to spell anything out. And I think there's a good reason for that. While the UK is keen and so far has been pretty successful in attracting condemnation from all of its Western allies against Russia, including from Washington, of course, and from the European Union. I think that that deep down the Brits know that actually translating that into any really tough action against Moscow might be quite another matter. So she's not called for that. Rather, she's talking about a mindset, saying, look, we need to think about Russia these days as a strategic enemy rather than as a strategic partner.
Is she in a tough spot in part because of Brexit and the negotiations going on with the EU there?
I think that certainly doesn't help. Look, I think Britain's Western allies, its allies in the European Union, are able to separate out their view of Vladimir Putin, of the Russian state, and of the utter horror of using a nerve agent to attack citizens on the streets of a quiet little English town. I mean, I think people know how to separate that out from their displeasure at Britain leaving the European Union. But look, there's no doubt. I guess it's all sort of vaguely mixed together in the sense that most of Britain's friends in the world would say, look, like it or not, your sort of clout in the world, your standing in the world has been reduced by your decision to leave the European Union. Not to mention that the whole process of Brexit politically just sort of takes up most of Britain's energy, or at least I should say perhaps the energy of its politicians.
Russia, as we said, denies any involvement in the nerve agent attack, and Moscow today also denounced a statement made yesterday by the British Foreign Secretary Boris Johnson, who agreed with a member of parliament who compared the upcoming World Cup in Russia to the Olympics hosted by Nazi Germany in 1936. Here's Johnson.
Yes, I think the comparison with 1936 is certainly right. And to think of Putin glorying in this sporting event.
A spokesman for President Putin called that an utterly disgusting statement. Is there any backlash in the UK over this statement from Boris Johnson?
Well, there certainly is. In part, of course, it's more from the Russians. So the Russian ambassador to London said that this was an insult to the Russian people who'd defeated Nazism, with over 20 million of them getting killed in the process. And I think there is a general feeling in the UK that while politicians don't have much time for Vladimir Putin here or his government, I think it is thought of as being a remarkably clumsy remark by Boris Johnson. I mean, just the idea of linking Russia, formerly the Soviet Union, to Nazism, given, again, the number of Russian Soviet citizens who were killed during the Second World War is massively unfortunate. And interestingly, asked again about his comments since then, Boris Johnson has not repeated them. And I noticed that most government ministers have been really keen to distance themselves.
Rob, one more thing. Today is the anniversary of the Westminster Bridge attack last year. It turned out to be the first of five terror attacks in the UK in 2017 that killed nearly 40 people. How is that anniversary resonating today?
Well, it's certainly resonating here in Westminster. I was at a lunch with politicians where we all stopped for a minute's silence, and you really could have heard a pin drop. There's been a service here again in Westminster, and there was a minute's silence in Parliament itself, in the chamber of the House of Commons, where MPs sat. I mean, beyond Britain, I don't know, maybe this is what happens in democracies, perhaps just in countries all over the world. I mean, it's one of those shocking things about terrorism attacks, the way in which a year on, most people, certainly the people not directly involved by the attacks, not the, you know, the emergency services, the victims, friends and relatives, it's just one of those, I guess it's a fact of life. People move on, but certainly marked very solemnly here within the confines of Westminster.
That's BBC's political correspondent Rob Watson joining us from London. Rob, thank you.
Good to be with you.
All this week, we're talking about bullying, which has moved online in a worrying way. Cyberbullying is such a big problem, it was the topic of discussion at the White House this week. So what should tech companies do about online harassment? Joining me now is Britton Heller, director of the Center for Technology and Society at the Anti-Defamation League. Britton, you come at this issue of cyberbullying from multiple angles. You're working with tech companies to better address online harassment, but you've also been a victim of cyberbullying yourself.
Yes, I have. 11 years ago, I was the Jane Doe in one of the first cyber harassment lawsuits while I was a student at Yale Law School.
What happened?
There was a website. It was supposed to be about law school admissions, but it wasn't. It was a chat forum where people would post messages that would target female students, minority students, and other people they went to law school with. I found myself targeted on the website. I tried to ignore it for several years until it started to have an impact on my real life and my ability to get jobs. When I went to the people who ran the website, they told me that I'd have to sue them to get it off. I had given them a line of code asking them to just de-index it from Google, that the content could stay up, but I needed it to not have an impact on my real life. And when they said, no, you'll have to sue us, I said, okay. So we had pro bono counsel from Stanford and Yale, and we filed suits. People thought that the suit would go to the Supreme Court, but instead I decided that it was a better idea to settle with the company. This was because by enacting terms of service and a content moderation regime, this meant that the type of abuse would never happen to another person targeted by that website. So it seemed like a better way to address the problem rather than potentially creating bad law.
So you have found in your experience that it is possible to get tech companies to do something to stop cyberbullying that the bullies can't just find a way around?
I found that there are very effective means. I run the Center for Technology and Society for ADL. So we run a problem-solving lab, and this is Facebook, Google, Twitter, and Microsoft. And they don't just bring their policy people, we've asked them to bring their engineers. So we're looking at cyber hate and cyber harassment, not just from the company policy standpoint, but from technological points of view as well.
So what should they be doing then, the tech companies? Can you give me an example of a tech company that has taken that step and it's worked?
Twitter's actually been taking many steps over the last 2 years. Some of the changes that they've announced have been allowing bystanders to report abuse. A lot of the times when you are being targeted online, it feels overwhelming. You have a deluge of negative comments every day. You have to read through them yourself, which is very, very taxing. And by allowing people who observe this to say something and do something about it, it doesn't put all of the burden on the target or the victim. If you look at what actually prevents harassment, some people have said that it's getting rid of anonymous speech, but the research doesn't support that. It's actually creating a social environment online where people don't feel like they can abuse others, where that's socially unacceptable. And by allowing bystanders to report, you start to create that environment.
We're looking all this week at the issue of bullying, and I want to ask you specifically how you think cyberbullying or online harassment is different than when somebody does it to your face.
There's a few different aspects of it. One, when somebody bullies you to your face, it's an ephemeral moment. It's painful and it's visceral, and then it's done. When someone bullies you online, depending on the way that they do it, it can show up in your Google search results. And because of the way the internet is structured, it may never go away. Also, the way that the architecture of the internet works, it places a lot of the burden on the target or the victim.
Because they've got to decide whether they should just get off Twitter or get off Facebook altogether.
Yeah. And for some people, like journalists or activists, being online is an essential part of their job. With the way the world is today, you can't tell people to just turn off their computer.
Is there a concern about free speech when you try to limit, as a tech company, what somebody can say to somebody else?
There are concerns about freedom of expression, but this is different than First Amendment concerns. The First Amendment governs government speech. So it says that the government is not allowed to censor you. Technology companies are governed by their terms of service. They are allowed to let anybody in or out of their platform. They are allowed to promote any type of rules for their online space. So under the law, they're allowed to do whatever they want. We don't want the companies to be the arbiter of free speech, but we want them to be responsive to community concerns.
That's Britton Heller, who is director at the Center for Technology and Society at the Anti-Defamation League. Britton, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, bullying is a big problem for people who identify as transgender. Meredith Toulousan is executive editor of Them magazine. She spoke with Here and Now's Peter O'Dowd.
Meredith, welcome. You say you, over the course of your life, you had to come out as gay. Later in life, you came out as transgender. And now recently, you've come out as a bully. How so?
Yeah, that's true. I think while I was in early transition, I was very insecure about myself. And one of the ways that I made myself feel better was to say disparaging things about other trans people, you know, people who I didn't feel were as beautiful as me or as passing as me. And in the context of that, I really did feel like I acted as a bully.
What did the bullying look like? What did you do?
Well, I mean, when people ask me this question, I always talk about mean girls, just because, you know, the part of it was that when I was in early transition, I watched a lot of teen movies because I was trying to get pointers.
You were trying
how,
to play
you know,
a
like,
role
I wasn't,
almost.
Yeah, like I wasn't socialized as a teenage girl, and I wanted to figure out how teenage girls behaved. And so I would say cutting things about people's appearance or the ways that people dressed. For instance, a lot of older trans women have a tendency to dress quote unquote younger than their age, in part because they didn't live, you know, that part of their lives, you know, as women. And so, you know, there's a certain amount of nostalgia. And, you know, like I was definitely like one of the first people to just be like, I don't think you should wear that top, or like, I don't think you should wear clothes that are that short, or
which would
what have
hurt,
you.
You know, that would hurt if you were feeling so exposed.
Of course, absolutely. You know, like, especially because, you know, like I myself was parading around in those clothes, right? You know, so there was this really, really strong double standard.
A lot of people might be hearing this and say, but you're like the one person who could have empathized with what your peers were going through at the time.
Yeah, absolutely. And at the time, I had, you know, very little self-awareness, really, of what was going on. It wasn't really something that I processed until many years later, right? And I think when you're in this sort of position of power relative to your friendship group, when you're perceived as the person who is passing, who is perceived by others as beautiful, those people around you require your approval in order to make themselves feel better. And so I sort of allowed to, you know, to have this attitude and this, you know, this standpoint in the world when in fact, you know, in retrospect, it was really, really, you know, it was a really big problem.
Yeah. What was your aha moment, that light bulb that went off in your head that made you say, what am I doing?
It was really funny because I was undisclosed for many years. So I moved right after I transitioned. And so my immediate community didn't actually know that I was trans for many years. And then after I publicly disclosed, then I was just exposed to all of these issues, like violence against trans women and trans people in general being so at risk for suicide and discrimination. Mm. And I sort of realized that I really played a part in this dynamic, right? And I'm being perfectly honest, I don't feel like I, you know, like even now am completely immune to really? That behavior,
how
right?
So?
You know, yeah. That it's sort of, you know, like it's just a button that gets pushed sometimes, you know, like when I get pushed to an insecure place, asserting, you know, that I'm cisgender passing, which means that people generally can't tell that I'm trans until I tell them. Is something that I still notice I do on occasion, and I try to hold myself accountable.
And isn't that exactly what is at the root of bullying, no matter what the reason is, whether it's someone in an LGBTQ community or just a schoolyard bully who has these secret insecurities? It almost doesn't matter. It's just a reflection of the way the bully is feeling on the inside. Do you think that's right?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. Maybe there are other explanations, but it's the one that feels most salient to me. Like, I have no reason, you know, to bully other people except to make myself feel better about my own insecurities. Mm-hmm. And also to try to project the things that I don't like about myself onto other people so that I don't have to confront them in, you know, like in my own psychology.
Meredith Toulousan, thank you so much for telling your story.
You're welcome.
And during yesterday's weekly roundup with political strategists, as the clock ran down, our Republican strategist, John Brabender, said this.
In 2010, the Democrats put an ad out on Craigslist saying they're looking for an adult film star to run as a Republican for Senate to create havoc in the Republican Senate campaign.
Oh, you
campaign.
Just dropped a stink bomb. We only have 15 seconds.
And you know who answered
yeah, by
that
the way,
and
can
announced
I make,
she was running?
Can I make clear, I disagree. I disagree with
you. Stormy Daniels,
Stormy
who
Daniels
announced she would run as a Republican.
We're going to promise to research that. John Brabender, Bob Schrum, thank you both so much.
Thank you.
This is
Take
here
care.
Now.
So, as promised, let's research with Mitch Ravelet, who wrote about this in the Bayou Brief. And Mitch, this hit home for John Brabender because the Republican incumbent John Vitter was his client in 2010, set the scene. Brabender made it sound like the DNC put out an ad for the challenger to Vitter, but it was some poli-sci students?
That is correct. And so what happened was, is there was a group of political science students from the University of New Orleans put out an ad, I believe it was on Craigslist, looking for an adult entertainer to run against Vitter, who, of course, had been found on the list of the D.C. Madam several years prior. Now, Vitter was in the midst of a comeback bid, and his approval ratings, while not great, were still high because of the fact that he was anti-Obama in a state that John McCain had won with almost 60% of the vote. And a lot of folks forget that the BP oil spill occurred in that year. And because of the drilling moratorium, a lot of Louisiana folks lost jobs, and that really raised Senator Vitter's profile here in Louisiana.
Yeah, so he was doing well, and along comes these poli-sci students who the person they end up drafting is Stormy Daniels, who is well-known in the area, and they thought that she would just draw attention to Vitter's extramarital activities. But she started speaking publicly to reporters. She had positions.
Yes, that is true. She was opposed to the Obama administration's economic stimulus package, and she was in favor of eliminating the income tax in favor of a national sales tax.
This was so big at the time. I mean, she made Jay Leno's Tonight Show monologue. She was really participating in this.
Very much so. She went on a listening tour around the state. She hired a noted political consultant down here in Louisiana, and very much working her candidacy as a female candidate, somewhat comparing herself to Sarah Palin and Hillary Clinton.
Well, then it took a dark turn. Her campaign manager's car was firebombed, as she herself was arrested in Florida, where she was actually living. She had a spat with her husband, and there was a domestic violence charge. And she ultimately didn't run. But you end your review of this by saying political reporters in the area thought they'd never hear her name again. Boy, were they wrong. Do you think people will see this then as, ah, the current Stormy Daniels headline is another attempt by the Democrats? She was drafted to sort of entrap Donald Trump. It's so odd that there are these parallels.
It is odd, and it's certainly open for interpretation that way, and that has been the line we've been hearing from a lot of Republicans, both locally and nationally, is this just proves that she's out there to make a political statement or to get more attention. There may be more depth to the story. To go out there and to go on the listening tour as she did, I think took a bit of more self-initiative. And so I can't really say one way or the other, but it has been very much so that that's been the standard line. But Democrats have come back and countered with, this was very much motivated by her, and she didn't enter the race as a Republican. She didn't enter the race as a Democrat. She was an independent, and not everywhere she went did she bring up David Vitter's scandal. She was talking about issues, and while the scandal came up, it was not her primary cause of concern when she was exploring this candidacy.
Yeah. Mitch Rabelais covers Louisiana politics for the Bayou Brief. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Great to be with you.
Let's take a break from the news now for the Here and Now DJ Sessions.
There goes the last DJ.
Oh, good. It's Mario Cotto who's back with us today, DJ for KCRW in Santa Monica, which means we're probably going to be talking about dance music. Mario, welcome back.
Yes, sir. Howdy do.
Okay, so
thanks for having me again, man.
It's good to have you, and let's get to some of the music. Here is Cause for Concern. This is by the LA music duo Deluxe. An upbeat start there. Tell us about this one.
This is off of Deluxe's third album, their latest release, More Disco Songs About Love. And so I was like taking my time with the album, feeling it out. And then one afternoon I was driving home and the sun was setting and I was on the freeway. And Cause for Concern came on and it just revealed itself to me. Mm. It like cracked me open like a nut and I just felt everything. And it's just like, I don't know, it's like a perfect shimmery pop nugget. And, you know, it's very clean, perfect pop music.
Well, they say that the latest album of theirs is about partying smart. What do you make of that?
Well, I think if you've been in L.A. and in the party scene and just things can go dark pretty quick. And Yeah, you do. And, you know, I was hanging out with them. They played Coachella last year, and they were hanging out at the rental that I got out in Palm Springs with a pool and stuff. And we were, like, barbecuing and, you know, we were partying. But, like, I think maybe that's the vibe. Maybe that's what they're talking about. Just, like, kind of, like, doing it nice but still having a great time.
Okay. Well, up next we have It Makes You Forget, Itge Hane. This is by Peggy Goo.
I'm
Now, it almost sounds like there's a Latin beat going on there, but Peggy Gu is Korean-born, based in Berlin.
Yeah. She's amazing. Like, I have a huge crush. I have to put this out there. She's just like the Rihanna of house music. And she's just materialized out of, like, the glittery ether. Just fully formed, like, just put out a bunch of really great mixtapes. And she's played, like, all of the best festivals, the biggest festivals, like Glastonbury, Deckmantle. And this is her first EP, and it's called Once. And it's just, like, this bouncy, perfect house. It feels like 1991 there.
And what's she singing about?
She's singing about the, like, the way that music can make you forget your woes, you know, transport you to somewhere else and just, like, puts you in a perfect place. Which is, like, that's totally classic house, you know, message. And, yeah, it's perfect. It's really, really great. She's spectacular. I'm really excited to see, you know, where she goes.
So, Peggy Gu, if you're listening, Mario is waiting for your call right now. We'll put the phone number at our website. So, let's get to the next one. This is MGMT here with When You Die. Can so hear that that is MGMT. It just could be no one else. And this is from their new album, Little Dark Age.
Oh, man. That song, the first time I heard it, I was in a record shop in Philadelphia. And it just, it stopped me dead in my tracks. I was like, what is this? Because those lyrics are just so brutal. Like, but it's such a poppy, pretty song. Like, it sort of, it reminded me of, like, I don't know, Fleetwood Mac or something, but like with the lyrical content of Steely Dan or something, just like so mean. But it's so good. I admittedly have never really been a huge MGMT fan. Yeah, there was just something about their psychedelia that I was like, trying to figure out always. And then this just like just blew me away. And so like listening to the whole album's great.
Yeah.
So yeah, I'm really excited about this. And you know, on that track, part of the reason I think that it's like a perfect pop track, it features Ariel Pink on backing vocals and guitar. It also features Conan Moccasin and Sebastian Tellier on background vocals. You know, all those dudes make left field, you know, avant pop kind of stuff. So I feel like maybe they were just in the room and they like created a monster. And When You Die is that monster. It's so good.
Okay, well, we have time for one more, and this is A Girl Like You. It's by Alaska Laska. I like that a lot. Very interesting.
It's so good. Do you recognize it?
No.
It was Edwin Collins. Like in the 90s, he had a song called Girl Like You. And it was like this very bombastic, I don't know, it felt like Tom Jones or something.
Hmm.
So this band, Alaska Laska, they're really new. I only found out about them through this compilation called Covered in Gloria that Bullion's label Deke put out. And it's a bunch of like really new artists putting out left field covers of like left field classics by like Joe Jackson, the Blue Nile, And yeah, so like they took on Edwin Collins' Girl Like You, and it's such a different take on it. It's really something.
Well, let's take a listen while we're talking about this to the song that you're talking about. Here it is. Hope that I'm talking allegorically. Know that I'm talking about the way I feel. And I've never known a girl like you before. And the new one, by the way, by Alaska Laska, which is not a band from Alaska, but from London.
Exactly. Yeah, they're like cut from that same cloth as like, you know, like Django Django or Hot Chip. Just kind of like super cheeky sense of humor, but like good groove.
Well, people can check out all these songs at our website, hereandnow.org. We're also on Spotify. You just search for NPR Here and Now, or you can find us on Apple Music. Mario Cotto, DJ at KCRW in Santa Monica, thank you as always.
Thank you, sir. Have a good one.
This weekend, there will be a march on Washington to protest mass shootings in schools, organized by the teens from Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High, who, of course, lost 17 beloved fellow students and staff when a former classmate opened fire in Parkland, Florida. They're now demanding that Congress pass tougher gun control laws, but so far they haven't. So in the absence of federal action, gun control advocates are urging states to take up the fight, and they point to Connecticut as a model. After the massacre at Sandy Hook Elementary School more than 5 years ago, that state passed some of the toughest gun laws in the country, and advocates say they're working. Anthony Brooks from member station WBUR reports.
Thanks for being here. Thank you. Appreciate it.
School safety and the shootings in Parkland, Florida, were the focus of a recent discussion at the Silver Lane Elementary School in East Hartford, Connecticut. The small group included Governor Daniel Malloy, teachers, and parents like Nicole Nathaniel.
A lot of kids are worrying. It kind of throws off their focus in the classroom. They should be focusing on their schoolwork, but they're wondering who's going to come through the building.
As a parent, Nicole Nathaniel understands that worry. Back in 2012, Adam Lanza shot his way into the Sandy Hook Elementary School in Newtown, killing 20 first graders and 6 educators. Since then, there have been more than 200 school shootings across the country, including the one in Parkland, Florida last month.
I think we've really reached a tipping point. I think Parkland struck a chord or a nerve.
This is Senator Richard Blumenthal, a Connecticut Democrat, who joined the discussion in East Hartford.
And the students who are in the streets and state capitals are demanding that we do better. The time for action based on the Connecticut model is now.
The Connecticut model is a series of gun measures that are among the toughest in the country, signed into law following Sandy Hook, after people like Poe Murray of Newtown demanded action.
I did not lose a child, but the shooter was my neighbor, and I have 4 children that attended the Sandy Hook Elementary School.
Murray heads the Newtown Action Alliance, which advocates for stricter gun laws. After the Sandy Hook shooting, advocates like her wanted Congress to take action, just like the students from Parkland, Florida are demanding now. But in the wake of the nation's worst school shooting, Washington did nothing.
We were completely heartbroken and very angry that they did not honor with action after the tragedy here. More importantly, though, what we did was we watched other mass shootings occurring over and over and again.
But where Congress failed to act, Connecticut did. State lawmakers expanded an assault weapons ban and outlawed high-capacity magazines. They required background checks for the sale of all firearms, tightened gun ownership regulations, and increased funding for mental health and school security. Governor Daniel Malloy pushed hard for the measures, signed them into law, and says they're working.
Crime is down here. Homicides are down here. Violent crime is down here more than it is anywhere else in the country in the last 4 years.
Malloy says Florida lawmakers should have passed similar laws after the 2016 attack on the Pulse nightclub in Orlando, when a gunman slaughtered 49 people.
If Florida had done, after the Orlando shooting, what Connecticut had done, the Parkland shooting couldn't have taken place.
There's no way to know that for sure. But it is true that the Florida killer bought his AR-15-style rifle, which is banned in Connecticut, legally from a Florida gun shop. According to the Giffords Law Center to Prevent Gun Violence, states with the strictest gun laws, like Connecticut, California, and Massachusetts, have the lowest rates of gun deaths, while states with the least restrictive laws, like Alaska, Alabama, Oklahoma, and Louisiana, have the highest.
I think what Connecticut did was go about it from the wrong approach.
Scott Wilson is among those who say Connecticut went too far and is trampling on Second Amendment rights. Wilson heads the Connecticut Citizens Defense League, which challenged the state's gun laws in federal court and lost. But he says a better way to make schools safer is to make them more secure and give teachers the means to defend themselves.
We do know that the killer in Sandy Hook shot his way into the school. And the first person that encountered Adam Lanza was the principal of the school, and she was, you know, summarily executed on the spot. And it would have been helpful if this person, Adam Lanza, had been met with proportionate response to put an end to his threat to the children in that school.
Wilson argues we protect banks and state capitals with guns. Why not schools?
I think that would be a fair solution as opposed to stripping and eradicating our constitutional rights little by little.
Back at the Silver Lane Elementary School in East Hartford, Governor Malloy says he wants to spend more on making schools safer, but he opposes arming teachers. Everybody here agrees with that, including the teachers, the parents, and Senator Richard Blumenthal.
The Connecticut model of school safety is a national model for how we can make schools safer without weaponizing our educators.
Since Sandy Hook, more than two dozen states have passed or introduced measures to loosen some of their gun laws. Following the shootings in Parkland, Florida lawmakers actually strengthened theirs. It remains to be seen if that's the start of a new trend. For Here and Now, I'm Anthony Brooks.
And Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.